I'm Chuck Osborne.
And I'm Michael Smith. Welcome to our podcast, which is presented by Assured Partners Investment Advisors,
where we talk investing and all things related in a way you can understand.
Woohoo!
Hey, this is Chuck.
This is Michael. It's Wednesday, June 10th, 2025, and this is the 19th episode of our podcast.
Woohoo!
Chuck, what's on your mind?
Missing companies, Michael. We got companies missing in action.
Well, where did they go?
That's a good question. But if you go back 25 years ago to the year 2000, there were approximately 7,000 publicly traded companies. And today, there are only 4,500. So we have actually shrunk in those last 25 years, even though the economy has grown dramatically.
So are there actually less companies?
No. What has happened is in that same year, of 2000, we had 2,000 approximately companies that were privately held, companies that were held by what we refer to as private equity. And today, there are over 11,500 companies that are owned by private equity. And they're kind of like that Matthew McConaughey movie, the failure to launch. They just continue to be held privately, and they're not going public.
Well, if you asked anyone, they think over the last 25 years, you'd think that a lot of companies would have been created. That means that we're, you know, an enormous amount of companies created over that time period, but they don't exist in public, in the public world, you know, as stocks as they used to always be. So I guess we got to go into what our thoughts on why that has happened and what's the underlying trends and drivers there.
Yeah. So what happened? I know, because you're absolutely right. Because if you go back to the 20th century, the lifespan of a company used to be, you know, you were a startup. Most of the time when you first started up, you would be funded primarily from your founders themselves out of their own back pocket.
Families.
Families, blood, sweat, and tears. There are so-called angel investors that sometimes will help people when they are truly first starting out. And then once you get, kind of your feet under you, and if you have some success as a business, you would draw, private equity investors. So, investors who invest in private companies. And those private equity firms back then, the entire game plan was they would come in, they would provide capital, invest in the company, help the company get to the kind of the next level, and then take them public. And, that was the whole idea. You would have an initial public offering. You would sell the shares to the markets, and then you would enter the world of small capitalization stocks. And then, if you continue to grow as a business, you would, grow from a small cap company to a mid cap company and eventually a large cap company. And that's why, back in those days when we would do 401k meetings and whatnot, we would say that small cap companies got the highest return over time and actually returned more than large cap companies. And that has not been the case for a very long time now.
Yeah, for a long time. Yeah. So private equity really started gaining some traction in the 80s, started becoming meaningful in the 90s. And then in the early 2000s is when you really started seeing enormous more capital move into private. It really went big in 2005, 2006. So why don't you discuss some of the drivers of, now some of this may be coincidence, I'm thinking not, but what really, how that occurred and why so much capital moved into private there in some ways.
Well, the biggest driving influence of that was a law that was passed in 2002, but that was during the George W. Bush administration, and it's called Sarbanes-Oxley. And this was in reaction to a couple accounting scandals that happened in the early 2000s. So you had Enron, which was an energy company out of Houston, Texas. And then you had WorldCom, which was a communications company. And in both of those cases, you know, I mean, the long story short was they committed fraud. I mean, they just fraudulently reported earnings that didn't really exist.
Yeah, they weren't real.
And they weren't real. And they were also, you know, in the case of Enron, they were hiding liabilities off of their balance sheet so that they were far more leveraged than they appeared to be. And, you know, and so, but, you know, at the end of the day, they were just being dishonest.
Yeah, they were just lying, fraudulent.
Right. And what happened was the both of those companies went under. Their auditor, their accountant, Arthur Andersen, which was one of what at the time was called the Big Eight, you know, accounting firms, actually went out of business. And you had, you know, the executives in those companies were, you know, indicted and convicted and served jail time.
Yeah, went to jail.
Yeah, because what they did what was already illegal, and I think that's a that's a big you know thing to remember, because this is, you know, what happens unfortunately sometimes in a democratic society when you have a highly publicized issue like Enron and WorldCom. Is that there's this pressure on the politicians to do something. And, you know, the fact of the matter is there were already, you know, there are already laws in place that made what happened there illegal. But, you know, it's kind of like the the movie where you had that double secret probation. Animal House. We had to make the law. We had to make it more illegal to cheat on your accounting paperwork. And the end result of that is that they've made it incredibly hard for companies to go public. And as a result, companies stay private much longer than they used to be. And the reason this is important is because, you know, the only people who can invest in private companies are institutions and wealthy individuals. You know, the average, you know, 401k participant, the average investor does not have access to those companies. So you've got all of these companies where average investors just don't have the ability to participate. You know, in them. And then what happens is they end up not going public until they're already large cap companies. And so the small caps have just been decimated because of that over the last 25 years.
Yeah. And to put it more about why they don't go public, you know, in 2017, you had some studies coming out that showed it, you know, it's roughly $2 million on average of additional costs to comply with Sarbanes-Oxley. Because what you have to do is, you have to have an external auditor who looks at all your internal controls. You end up hiring all these consultants to make sure it's done properly. You get sign off by a lot of different people. It's just a really extensive process. And if you're a very small company, that's a very large annual additional cost. And they'll just push it off and not do it and stay private is one of the reasons. I mean, that's what happens there. It's crazy expensive for a small company.
Right. And this is what, you know, to me, Sarbanes-Oxley is the poster child for bad regulation. and this is always the danger with regulation. And regulation is a tough thing to talk about because, you know, it's nuanced. I mean, no one obviously wants to have zero regulation. No one wants to live in a world where there are no rules. That would be very bad. But that's always the straw man that comes up anytime someone starts talking about, we need to cut back on regulation. We need to reduce regulation. Sarbanes-Oxley is a great example of this. So, you know, the bad acts that happened that Sarbanes-Oxley is supposed to quote unquote fix were already illegal. I mean, yeah. We already had laws in the books to deal with fraud. And so, you know, you look at it from that standpoint, there was no need for additional legislation. But now when the politicians got on board and they say, okay, well, we're going to do something. Well, the group that is probably most impacted by this is the accounting firms. You know, I mean, Arthur Andersen ended up, you know, collapsing because of what happened with Enron. And they were highly incented to get, you know, get their lobbyists out there, get in front of all of these congressmen and go, well, these are all the things that need to be done. And they've just made it a boon. So that $2 million you're talking about, where does that go? It goes to the pockets of accounting firms.
Yeah.
Who, you know, lobbied extensively to get this law passed. And again, it's one of those issues where instead of taking accountability, and you think about the case of Enron, you know, Enron, you know, came public because a newspaper magazine reporter, you know, who a young magazine reporter who had a degree in English, looked at the financials at Enron and said, this doesn't make sense. And you're telling me that all the accountants that have accounting majors that have passed the CPA exams that are working at Arthur Andersen couldn't have done the same thing? Obviously, they were turning a blind eye because they didn't want to lose a client. And so they turned a blind eye to what was going on there. And they got punished, and rightfully so. But now they're highly incentive to, don't let any crisis go to waste. And they lobby Congress, and they end up creating a world where all of a sudden their revenue goes up dramatically. You know, and then who does it hurt? It hurts the thousands and millions of actual everyday investors who don't have access to invest in these companies. But none of them, are even aware, to be quite frank, that this is going on. So they don't have a large voice. And this is kind of what happens with the problem with regulation, is that you've got a small group who's going to benefit dramatically, who is highly incentive to lobby for their cause against the greater good, who to them, you know, this is something that a lot of times they don't even notice.
And think about so this is some speculation here, but still, I think it's something to talk about. So, you know, prior to 2000, you mentioned it, small caps were the best place to be, right? Over very long periods of time, excess returns went to smaller companies. And roughly since then, that hasn't happened anymore. So, you know, then you have to ask, well, does that mean that there was a higher quality contingent of those small companies that were eaten up by private equity? And therefore, those excess returns were only gotten by not mom and pop investors, but they were then harvested by institutional investors, other investors that are already way up the socioeconomic ladder. And so not only is that the group that then captures excess returns that used to be captured by individual people, Wall Street itself is hugely benefited by these enormous amount of excess fees because, you know, private equity, the fees in private equity funds, you know, they may not quite be this level, but still it's, you have a upwards of 2% fee on top of sometimes a 25%, you know, piece of the returns that you get. And you just get, it's an enormous boon for Wall Street, an enormous boon for accounting firms, an enormous boon for institutional investors. And it really hurts mom and pop and everyday people.
No, and that is exactly right. And it is, which, you know, basically leads, this is the poster child for why I think it is so important for there to actually be regulatory reform, which hopefully is, you know, going to happen now over the next few years. And hopefully it's thoughtful regulatory reform. But the but you're exactly right. You have a piece of legislation that has actually benefited Wall Street, if you will, specifically the private equity world, which has just, you know, exploded in size. I mean, you just look at the number of companies, or approximately 2,000 companies back in 2000, 25 years ago, and there's 11,500 today. And to your point, the fees associated with managing private equity are at least double, if not four times,
if not considerably even
what,
higher than
what the fee would be for a money manager to manage a small company, you know, mutual fund, or ETF, or, you know, however you want to do that. And it's, so it's good for Wall Street. It's obviously good for the consulting and accounting world. It is basic. I mean, it's, you know, been a boon for them. And the people that get hurt by it are, you know, to some degree, perhaps business owners, you could argue, because it's not as easy for them to actually go public. Which used to be the big payout for people who founded companies. That's and that was the, you know, the ultimate goal, and where you finally got that reward for all the blood, sweat, and tears that you put into actually building something. And but mostly the people that have been hurt have been the average investor, say the 401k investor, who doesn't have access to those kinds of companies. And this is also typical of what happens once you skew a market like this. You know, today there is actually a movement to get private equity funds into 401k plans so that 401k investors can have access to them, which would be better than nothing. But to your point, you know, the fees on those private equity funds are substantially higher than what they would be if those companies were public and small caps, and you could simply invest in them the way that we did as recently as the 1990s, you know.
Well, there's also other issues. I mean, to own a private company, right, you can't just sell this on the market. That's the point of it being private, right? So within a 401k, a person can't just go in and put a sell order for 100% of a private company fund at the end of the day and get out of it. There's an enormous amount of other hurdles that become really difficult to jump through.
Absolutely. And you also have, we are now at a stage where this is not sustainable. As a matter of fact, there's been some studies that have come out and pointed this out. But, you know, private equity, the difference between private equity and public equity, in both cases, you're buying companies. You're buying generally either the stock, or it could be debt. But most of the time here, we're talking about equity. We're talking about the stock of a company. It's a matter of whether that company is a privately held company, which is where the stock is not traded on the open market, or a publicly held company where the stock is traded on the public market. And you can go out any time between 9:30 and 4 o'clock Eastern time on a weekday and sell that company, sell that stock if you want to. With private equity, you got to find a buyer in order to have a liquidity event. And generally what happens when these funds is, I mean, they can be structured many different ways, but the rule of thumb is that they lock money up for about 5 years. So you put money into one of these private equity funds and they're saying, you know, you're promising to keep that money in there for 5 years. and in 5 years, we're going to pay you back. And so that tends to be the window of time that private equity funds want to own businesses. And then they got to find a seller. And again, historically, the way that used to work is that the private equity fund would take the company public within 5 years.
Yeah.
You know, and that was going to be the payoff. Today, what they're doing is they're trying to find another private equity group that will come in and buy the shares from them. And then, you know, and then they trade this back and forth. And, you know, but eventually what happens is that the companies simply get too big for that to occur.
Yeah. And now we're at a place now that could, well, who knows how long this takes, but we're at a moment where many companies have been owned by private equity much longer than the private equity firms want to own them. There's a ton of these companies that they're looking for exits. They're trying to find ways to do it. And again, you know, people don't want to go public still. They don't think they're going to get the valuation that they currently have. There's a lot of reasons you could go into that, but something has to happen. And it's most likely, one would think, my personal view is you're going to have more companies that are going to have to eventually go public here than were, because I just don't see any other way. I don't see any other way an exit happens for these people.
Right. Well, the great thing or the best possible outcome, in my opinion, and this is, you know, my opinion, other people would differ, but I don't think it's likely. But the best outcome would be to actually repeal Sarbanes-Oxley. I mean, completely. Take it off the books. I think, is one of the worst pieces of legislation that's ever been passed in U.S. history. And take it off the books. Go back to the way the rules were in the 1990s. And then what's going to happen is it's going to be much easier for companies to go public. And then you can get that exit ramp. And you get the benefit of everyone gets to invest in these companies if they wish to. You're not limiting the investment to only those people who are already accredited or institutional investors. And that would be the solution. That's probably not likely to happen because that would entail us having a functioning Congress. But in the meantime, they can at least water it down. And there have been in defense, we're not the only ones who have noticed this. There have been a couple instances, since 2002 when this has passed, where they have tried to carve out windows for certain size companies and so forth to try to make it easier for them, because they understand that they've made it so hard for companies to go public that what they've really done is they have sheltered the public from being able to invest in what are in many cases, the best small companies out there. And there are household name examples of this, Michael, that you and I know about. I mean, Facebook is probably the biggest. And now people have still been successful, and you've been able to invest now in Facebook, now Meta, for many years. But they didn't come public until they were already, one of the largest companies in the country. Uber came public as already a big, large cap company. You could go down a list of many companies that, you could have had those when they were still small.
Yeah.
And the growth that you would have had as an investor in those companies would have been so much more substantial. But all of that growth ended up going to, private investors, because they were the only ones that could have access to that.
Well, this brings up another point too, which is, and we'll see how this stuff plays out, because they have made some carve outs where they made it easier, and you did not see floods of companies coming public on those, even the ones that it made sense. They saw a little bit more, but not floods. And so then the question, and we won't know until we see some changes, But the question is, how much more attractive is it for a company to stay private versus going public? There's a, you know, the quarterly earnings race and the short-termism that the market has. I mean, in 1950, the average holding period of a company was 8 years. It's gone steadily down to, last I saw, was something like 4-5.5 months, right? We've become a trading world in the investment world. There's algorithmic traders. And so the world has changed there. It's made it a little harder to, in my opinion, to be public than it used to be. And so, you know, you do wonder, even if you do that, do you get a flood? Do you get a trickle? What that actually looks like in the real world? I think you definitely would get more companies becoming public, but the question is how many?
Yeah. And the other problem with the carve out, Michael, is that the, you know, in the back of your minds, you know that, okay, we're exempt, you know, right up front from these regulations. So it's easier for us to go public now.
Yep.
And we'll be exempt as long as we're small.
Yeah, as long as we don't go over a certain threshold.
But once we hit that threshold, all of this kicks in. Mm-hmm. And the whole purpose, you know, the whole goal of going public, you know, was to continue the growth.
Yes, to keep growing. You need that capital, theoretically, right?
Right, right. You're bringing on capital, and you're going to use that capital to you know, to go to the next level and the next level of a business. This is the lifespan of an individual company. You know, it starts as an idea. You know, it gets founded. You get the private investor. You go public. You grow. You become large. Then you become too large, and you start to decay. And then you eventually go out of business.
Yeah.
And that's the lifespan.
That's the lifespan of a company.
And what has happened is, because of regulation, we have kind of short-circuited a big chunk of that lifespan and kept these companies in the private market. And it's a real issue. It's going to have ramifications, you know, at some point. You don't know exactly when that point is. But we may be getting close to it, because you're having issues today where private equity funds are supposed to be returning capital to their shareholders.
And they are not.
And they can't, because they can't find buyers for these businesses that they own, because they've been in this private equity treadmill for multiple rounds now. Mm-hmm. And these are companies that are already mid-cap, large-cap companies that should be public and should have been public a long time ago. And I think one stat that I saw was that something like 87, I'm doing this from memory, so forgive me, but it's like 87% of the companies that have more than 100 million in annual revenues are privately held. And, you know, 100 million is not big from when we think of these mega cap technology companies that we think about. But when you think about the Russell 2000 and some of those companies down there, I mean, that's we're talking substantial revenues.
Yeah.
And these are opportunities for investment that should be available in our view to the public. Yeah. But aren't because, you know, because we needed to be, you know, protected from, you know, Enron, which, you know, and I wrote about that years ago, but as I said, it was an English major who discovered that Enron's books did not make sense. I personally, it's completely anecdotal, it's not a study, but, you know, I was working at Invesco at that time. I don't know a single active manager that had Enron in their portfolio. Anyone that looked at them, the investors, other than the people that worked there or investors that bought the stock directly, you know, that just didn't know what they were doing. The only other people I know that had access, you know, exposure to Enron at that juncture were the index funds, because it was part of the index. I think most people knew that there was something
didn't smell right.
Something didn't smell right.
Yeah, it didn't make sense. Yeah.
And sure enough, that was the case. And, you know, unfortunately, because of that, we've ended up having some unintended consequences that have really kind of decimated a big part of the market and taken that away. And this is, again, it's a great example of, I think, why thoughtful regulatory reform would be a great thing that could unleash a lot of economic growth and a lot of opportunities for everyone if it's done right. And personally, I would start by repealing Sarbanes-Oxley.
get rid of SOX, as they call it.
Get rid of the SOX. No SOX. That's right. I grew up in South Florida, Michael. Flip-flops, here we go.
No SOX. All right, well, thanks, y'all. I think that's probably a good time. So we appreciate it. You know, as always, reach out. Let us know anything you'd like to hear about, and we will talk to you guys next time.
Sounds good.
Chuck Osborne and Michael Smith are investment advisors. Representative of Assured Partners Investment Advisors, LLC, a registered investment advisor. All statements and opinions expressed in this program are based upon information considered reliable, although statements or opinions are subject to change without notice. Information expressed does not consider the specific situation or objectives of any person and is not intended as a recommendation appropriate for any person. Viewers are encouraged to seek advice from a tax or legal professional or investment advisor to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. Investments involve risk, and unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed.